What was the plan or the mindset? Was it like, I'm just glad I made the team. I'm just coaching a lot and this is great. Or was it, were you trying to connect the dots to some like vaguer, bigger plan?
No plan. Just, can I enjoy the day-to-day process? I asked myself, am I enjoying and getting motivated to go to work? If I don't have that feeling, it doesn't matter what level or whatever you have, it's unhealthy. I knew pretty quick that, watching my mentors, if someone's happy and they're smiling, then I want to do that. It's not the how much you make or who you're working with or whatever. The question is, are you enjoying the day-to-day process?
Welcome to the Talking Shop podcast, sharing stories, lessons, and experiences in sports performance and professional development. I'm joined by Carl Valley, Spikes Only, the man, the myth, the legend. How are you doing today? And tell me something good that's going on in your life.
Oh boy. Something that's good with all the doom scrolling with climate change and other challenges with Ukraine and Russian war skirmishes near the nuclear power plant. It's hard to get something positive when you wake up and the world's in chaos. But I'm just really amped right now this morning because I'm making a conscious effort to have an inspirational scroll of good news. So cool things that people are doing with climate change. They're I know this is a sports performance side, but the health and well-being of any type of coach. There's been some new research saying that coaches are at more risks with mental health issues than the athletes. So they did a survey with some really high caliber coaches and they talk about all the mental health issues. So, for me to, I've been focusing on looking at good news on the environment, seeing how people are, how great innovation is solving a lot of the big problems. So I feel a little bit better day to day. So, that was a long-winded explanation saying I'm doing okay because I'm trying to read and learn some positive things, which is very important right now.
Fantastic. So Carl's Spikes Only, that's how people probably know him by. I'm not exactly an amateur internet stalker, but I wasn't able to find much. But he's been coaching for over 20 years in speed, power events, mainly sprints and hurdles. He's created a ton of content. He has 19 pages of articles on Simply Faster. That's like over 100 articles. Oh my gosh. Very impressive, I must say.
So that's funny. So a good thing with the kind of a timeline, because when people say 20 years, it gets fuzzy with like, okay, what years count? And I'm not going to count the years of when you're volunteering and you just don't know any better. So I think that, when people look for my perspective, I can only give them my experiences starting as an athlete in high school and college. I was dabbling in endurance sport in college, but in high school, I did track and field and swam. We won 3 state titles in swimming. We won some class titles in track. I was basically a fish out of water. While I love track and field, I'm just not gifted there. So I was not successful at that and focused on swimming. And then Massachusetts, the Northeast isn't as competitive as like California, Texas, and Florida. So, when someone says, hey, you're a state champion or league champion, well, with so many high schools, with 30,000 high schools, almost everyone's going to be a sectional champion. This is so many competitions. So I decided to go to college in the University of South Florida in Tampa because I wanted to be involved with sports training somehow. When I was an athlete, it was either you're a team coach. We didn't know what strength and conditioning was. Now, clearly strength and conditioning has been around for decades, but when you grow up and you don't have a strength coach, it's usually your high school team coach that's guiding a circuit or something. You don't know that, hey, there could be a specialist that is just focusing on the non-sport training. So what got me hooked was in college, I was watching some Olympic athletes training on the track, and we're talking single leg hurdle jumps over like 36 inches.
Oh my God.
So if you go and see that video of Linford Christie on YouTube, that is not CGI. That's an old grainy VHS tape of him with one leg hopping, real hurdle hops, not jumping with two legs, but jumping with one, which is a hop, over 36 to 39 inches on the hurdles.
Wow.
And when I saw that, and you see that stuff in person, when you see someone like clean with a body weight of 200 pounds, like 375 or whatever, and they drop it on the cement and it just cracks, like, you know, this isn't like, you know, some sort of like fitness center. This is like different. So when you're exposed to, like, in high school and you're just doing, like, you know, push-ups and stuff like that, you don't really understand what's possible with strength and conditioning. Now, keep in mind, as a swim coach, you know, I coached swimming for 10 years and I coached track. So outdoor track and swimming was during the winter. Not a great combination, because indoor track in the Northeast is important to build, you know, success. So I did most of my high school coaching. I coached high school for 10 years. And, you know, that was great. I, you know, right around 2:45, the day started for track and field. Swimming, we did great. I coached, swimming for, you know, about half the time of Olympic sport. But then it came a point where I had to make a decision. And so after, you know, I'll get more into that with your questions. And then the same time, I was doing strength and conditioning at different facilities. A good person I'd probably recommend to talk about high school strength and conditioning is Tim Crowley. And I was with him for a couple of years at Longfellow. So, you know, dabbled in a little everything, a little bit of combine prep, a little bit of anything that came, which you don't really have to search for. It just falls into your lap. You can dabble. We did some stuff with bobsled. We did some stuff with baseball, high school tennis and stuff like that. Lots of performance stuff. And it was just kind of random. And then recently I started doing more work with sports technology, obviously with when I was with Simply Faster, before they were with Freelap. Technology started to grow. So I started doing some consulting. I did some work with the Houston Rockets. It was my first sports tech real project, you know, when I said, okay, I'm going to be doing this as a business rather than a courtesy to friends. And then from there, it started to grow. And here we are. I do mainly sports testing and do some remote coaching, you know, with correspondence programs. And a lot of it is product development with technology. So hopefully that background kind of gives you the timeline.
Yeah, I'm super excited, whether it's in this episode or kind of off air, to learn about the consulting and kind of making it happen on your own. You know, being in the private side, although I've been kind of trying to make it back to college, that's a different story. But the fact that you can literally make it what you want to make it, and you can create and mold, because there's so many opportunities, even with a narrow focus of tech and speed and sports science. But I'm excited to get into kind of all the stories, lessons, and experiences that have kind of brought you to now. So you're from the Massachusetts, Boston-ish area. Spend time in Florida, then how on earth are you a 49ers fan?
Oh, well, that's part of the origin story, right? Like, I was reading a article on Sports Illustrated about Jerry Rice, and I just love the work ethic as an athlete. You know, like, I'm not talented. And so, yeah, training gets you better. Rice is obviously very talented, but hard work and great talent is legendary. So I looked at his training, obviously what he did with volume and running up, you know, maybe that worked for him. He clearly was inspired me, and then, you know, fell in love with the 49ers. And this is the time where, you know, the Patriots, you know, we got embarrassed in the Super Bowl in the mid 80s, and the Patriots were not there, not until the early 2000s or late, actually technically when Parcells got us to his Super Bowl. You know, I had mixed feelings. I started to fall in love with the local team. But then, you know, my heart was in San Francisco. So, you know, you can draw your conclusions.
Fantastic. So let's start with post. I guess we'll go kind of chronologically as opposed to like the kind of big three stories, because I would assume that those will kind of come up. So let's start with post USF. What was the first gig out of college?
So senior year and the senior and the year after, I transitioned. I did about two seasons with the Tampa Bay Rays. The joke is that as soon as I left, they dropped the devil. But that's, you know, another story. But
correlation isn't causation. But
yes, exactly. You know,
maybe but,
Yeah, someone in my family made that joke, and it, you know, it was pretty funny. But you know, during that time, I was graduated, and I didn't know what to do because I did my final practicum with USF football with Doug Elias, and that's when Ronnie McKeefry was like.
I was going to say, did you run into him?
Yeah, Ronnie McKeefry was there. This is when the Tampa Bay Buccaneers were using like hammer strength circuits and the hit. Talk about debates, you know, with, you know, the internet wasn't as nasty as it was, but people got emotional, you know, in the machines versus the free weights, multiple sets, and you know, plyos, you know, some people said plyos are, you know, blow up an athlete and they don't do anything. So that was the time, the summer I did a practicum with USF football. That was awesome. We had Wednesday speed school. So it gave me some time to just go out there on the USF track and just work with a handful of athletes. I saw how to run a program versus coach a team. Big difference. My high school coach was a wonderful mentor in terms of being organized, but you know, obviously college is a little different. I worked at the Strike Zone in Tampa, and we had a performance center, and we had some decent athletes go through that, but it was very embryonic. Like, people didn't appreciate strength conditioning. They understood it, but they really didn't understand how to shop around for it. You know, do you go to a personal trainer that understands protein bars and is a bodybuilder, or do you hire a running coach to do mileage? Like, it was bad. But there was some really good stuff going on, some great people. During that time, you know, I was doing the Tampa Bay Rays. The afternoons were the Strike Zone. And then I still did some coaching of track, some post-collegiate track. And that was very difficult because that was the years where, you know, NCAA rules were saying, okay, what's a professional? Mm-hmm. Are you allowed to share? And that was just really problematic. And the track wasn't technically owned by the college. Is owned by a company that kind of ran it, and you know, they stopped in 2001. They basically closed down the facility. So that's when I head back to Massachusetts and started from there. So that's kind of where I got my you know, I started with going to Longfellow was a private facility, and we did, you know, I was able to coach swimming, high school track, high school swimming, and then did the strength and conditioning there.
What was your role with the Rays and how did you get in with them?
I was an intern, and the program brought in a whole bunch of different professionals to speak my junior, senior year of college in our program. And they brought in Kevin Harmon, who is an awesome guy and was in pro baseball for decades. And he spoke and said, hey, this is what you need to do. And, you know, there was like some duties that were not glamorous to do, to say the least. But then it's like, you know, observation. You did coach. And that was my first time basically coaching strength and conditioning. I knew how to train, but, you know, there is a lot beyond that. And, you know, it was weird because, you know, childhood hero Wade Boggs was there, and, you know, that was the first athlete I met, you know. Wow. And he was really nice, shook my hand and, you know, did some dumbbell bench press or something like that. But, and then I did that for on and off for 2 years, really difficult with, trying to go to college, trying to, you know, early in the morning, I might have to drive. And I lived in Tampa, and the stadium was about 45 minutes away. That was the good old days when like gas was a dollar.
Oh, throwback.
So that was it. And, you know, I mean, I think that was a really important period of my time to learn without having the pressure, you know, like you're there for learning. You could get responsibilities, but Ken Crenshaw was the athletic trainer there, Jamie Reed. And then, you know, they sent me around to other places. They were very generous. I owe a lot to them because, you know, I'd go and do an anatomy review, a dissection of a lumbar spine. And, you know, they'll just send you. And they were so patient, you know, asking questions, you know, with me asking questions on really bad topics. I mean, like, I was convinced that ribose was going to be the next creatine. I just, you know, you're learning. And so you're making a lot of mistakes on paper first before you would apply them. So those guys were excellent. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it sounds like a cool opportunity at a high level like the Rays, but also to have that, not lack of pressure, but the ability to like experiment and learn and try. And the joke my mentor always says was, one day I showed up and then he was just in charge of my questions for the rest of the summer.
Yeah.
So it's all about having that one or two or multiple kind of foundational coaches that can like let you feed your curiosity bug, because, you know, that's all training is asking questions and figuring out how to answer them over time. But so that was kind of the first stint. So then you moved back to the Great Northeast. And what was next there?
Yeah. So between Longfellow, there was a facility that I was at called Excel around 2006. So, you know, the early 2000s was Longfellow. And then right around 2006, a facility opened up in Waltham, Massachusetts. And there's some really good people there. It was sort of like it was a private facility. Obviously, it's small independent contractors. And, you know, did that for, you know, 3 or 4 years. And then that was when I was basically hitting a wall in terms of time and identity. A good example was 2008, during the Olympics, we had basically in the winter time, having an indoor track is a luxury. So we had to use the Reggie Lewis Center. And there was a hurdler that I had from Puerto Rico that went to the Olympics, and we had to train after the high school track meets were. Well, when you have 3 or 4 high school track meets, you don't start training until 8. Mm-hmm. So that was the time we trained from 8 to 10, would drive to lift, and he would have dinner probably at 10:45 and would eat like at a Chinese food restaurant, you know, symbolic of Beijing, I guess. And we did that because I didn't have like a facility. You know, obviously I wasn't a college coach then. I coached college later in 2009, but it was a lot. And then afternoons was high school coaching for track, or and then also between high school coaching was the strength conditioning side. So I'd go to the facility and we'd be there from like, you know, 6 to 7:30, or, you know, 2 hours or so, like maybe 5 to 5:30 if it's an earlier session. So it was really difficult to string high school, private sector, post-collegiate. And I did that for a little bit too long, and then consolidated just to coach track, you know, as a community college for a couple of years as well. And, you know, just learning with just random environments, which is, it was like the born supremacy. Like you talk about on the fly. What if you don't have a locker room? You know, like that's crazy. There's a lot of challenges, you know, training at 8 o'clock at night. Well, guess what? The community college was in the same boat we were, at their own facility. So we had to train at 8 o'clock to 10, and you would have athletes that really were juggling a lot, sometimes having a job, sometimes going to school, getting tutored. It was a battle, but that was probably my most rewarding period of my life is community college coaching, because giving opportunities to athletes, there was a lot at stake. So to me, that was a great time.
Were some of those opportunities like the Puerto Rican Sprinter or the JUCO, the high school SNC, were all of those ones looking back that like found you, or were you intentionally going out and seeking out kind of more and different and variety?
They found me. I don't know. I don't remember when Roxbury Community College, was something that the Reggie Lewis Center, I don't know if you know the Celtics player that had a heart attack, and they donated you know, basically to create a community place gosh, it's like about 30 years ago. So that was, I think I found out about that from when I was coaching another college. I would bump, you'd go to the same meets because what's cool about track and field is you can go D1, D2, D3, and then maybe open. So post-collegiate, you have a post-collegiate, and then the heats would be mixed with different, it was all about ability rather than what division or even age. So that was just basically casually bumping into the coach, and he was just an entertaining guy, but I really liked his mindset. He was a really tough, I mean, he lived in Massachusetts, came from, that area and really understood the sport. He was a triple jumper and it was fun. He did a great job. So that was sort of just happenstance. Hector, he was talking to someone and then there was a mutual introduction because I just was in the area. There's not a lot in Boston in terms of, there's a handful of sprint coaches, but you got some great stuff at Harvard and BU now, but back then it was sort of like quarter mile and above. It wasn't really a sprint capital by any means.
And then last question on these kind of formative years. What was the plan or the mindset? Was it like, I'm just glad I made the team. I'm just coaching a lot and this is great, or was it were you trying to connect the dots to some like vaguer, bigger plan?
No plan. Just can I enjoy the day-to-day process? To me, when I look at stuff that I've been doing starting, I remember for a really short period of time, gosh, I think I don't remember exactly, but I asked myself, am I feeling that I'm having, am I enjoying and getting motivated to go to work? Or did some of the, if I don't have that feeling, it doesn't matter what level or whatever you have, it's unhealthy. I knew pretty quick that, watching my mentors, if someone's happy and they're smiling, then I want to do that. It's not the how much do you make or who you're working with or whatever. The question is, are you enjoying the day-to-day process? And some people at the elite level, it is a job. They don't like doing what they do, and they're honest about it. They say, "Hey, I'm just pretty good about doing XYZ." And if that makes them happy, that's great. I think you can do both. I think it's harder to do both. It's usually a compromise. Do you want to go a certain road or do you want to, there's a lot of burnout in this field. Whatever coaching, whether it's team coaching, strength and conditioning, if it's track and field, sports, I don't know if it's not easy, and especially with a coach, your career is decades. Now technically you could be 25 years old and you've already competed for 10 years, but usually that's when you start coaching. So you might be in sports for a decade as an athlete. So to me, it's just, can I wake up and not have dread?
It's crazy how it goes from like how can I create this perfect life to like, am I gonna want to wake up? You know, am
Yeah,
I gonna be
well.
excited to have my alarm go off? You know, as I'm definitely not dealing with my own quarter life crisis. That's a story for a different podcast. But so next we get through these, you know, 3, 4 years of just coaching and putting together all these different opportunities. What was next? Is this when the college happened?
Yeah, I mean, I coached at D3,
Babson.
D2. Yeah, I coached
Haha.
a year of D3. After I was coaching high school for a couple of years at Dover Sherborne, and that's when the first year it was tough because it was reminded me of it's a tiny school, and the goal was simple: get our relays to go to the state meet and compete. And like the first year we broke the girls 4x1, and that was an interesting year because the girls program was very strong and heavy in the upper class, and then the guy side was younger talents. And then the next year after that, they broke the 4x1 with the guy side, and then my colleague, a friend of mine, Matt, ended up taking over the role and lowered the 4x1. So it was just great to see continuity. On the third year, while I went to Babson for a year, and I was the jumps coach. So basically, I was a performance enhancement coach for the jumps. I was, to be fair, I can make you jump far, I can make you jump high, but consistency was an issue. We end up having our first, I think maybe our only conference champion in the high jump. And she had a knee pathology, so we weren't allowed to do plyos or lift weights.
Fantastic.
So when you have a high jumper that's not technically allowed to jump, has a knee pathology, how do you get that to work? Now, she could do approach work. Sometimes she could compete. So the question is, could you do disc rehearsal? So for her, that was an interesting project because we didn't really have, you know, much to work with. On the triple jump, we had a guy that had, I think, a major career risking injury. Like he had a major surgery and he made a comeback. And, you know, the program was early. So like just being a program, you're going to get school records. That's when I realized that you can set a school record and not be proud, because just starting a program, there's going to be, you know, dozens of records set that year. So it was in the middle of its progress. That was a tough year because I learned that Division Threes was harder than Division Two. Because
how about compared to JUCO?
JUCO, I felt was, I don't know. See, it's hard to compare. It's not just levels, but it's also environments. You got educational environments. A colleague of mine had a great year at MIT this past year and probably was the best program for men's and women's combined. And I think he got like third at the national meet. Think about that. Just going to MIT alone is draining. Could you imagine a sport that you're traveling and competing for so long? So all of it is mixed. I just find that, you know, you'll find environments that are going to be very that are very challenging. I'm not fit for teams except for high school. College is fine. There's recruiting. You know, I didn't really recruit that much. It's just a lot of work. So I think scholastic coaching, I either like post-collegiate or pre-collegiate, which is high school or club. College was fun. I enjoyed it, but that is a long season. It's a lot of hours and you can't choose and pick the meets that you want. With post-collegiate, you could say, you know what, we're not going to do anything in April. Well, that's a choice. But in college, you have a schedule and there's a reason for that. So I loved every situation at different levels and had success and had some challenges that were very humbling. But, you know, without taking risks is a risk, you know. So that was basically my summary of that period of time.
Mm-hmm. So 1 year at Babson, how many years D2 and what school is that again?
I was at University of UMass Lowell.
Okay.
And I did that for 2 years. First year was, again, I was a jumps performance coach, meaning we're going to try to jump far. And we had some great success. Give the credit to the athletes. As you know, the more talent that you have, it's nice to see the results of that. And, you know, did that. And then after that, did 2 years of Roxbury Community College. And then that was sort of the end of the college coaching side. Just because as I got older, those hours became very difficult. And, you know, different options were popping up. And it wasn't like I was like not happy with college coaching. It's just that in Massachusetts, you know, there's a handful of schools, and, you know, that is a grind. And it's, you know, some things that I really like about high school that I don't like about college. There's some things I love about college that you'll never get at high school. And then, of course, post-collegiate, that becomes a business. I mean, like, how do you get to Europe with a budget? You know, what if you can't even fly sometimes if you don't have two or three athletes at the meet? So it becomes, you know, with post-collegiate was very non-track and field financial. And high school was all about, you know, making sure that the logistics were taken care of. And then college was a combination of budgeting and, you know, I didn't do any of that. But, I mean, you might have responsibilities that, you know, like a golf tournament, you know, that has nothing to do with strength and conditioning. But, you know, if you're a track coach, you might have to do a 5K race and raise funds for your program. So, you know, strength and conditioning coaches tend to have a lot of the speed and agility camps in the summer. High school coaches have to do that sometimes, and you can use the recreation center. But it's tough out there. You know, if you want to do what you want to do it the way that you want to do it, that requires a little bit of bureaucracy, you know.
For sure. So post your college days, as you alluded to, was the post college. Yeah. How did that come to be?
Well, then I transitioned to more of, I started networking with other people with great facilities that were like-minded on the performance side. I worked with a handful of athletes in soccer that got me more aware of kind of the needs to, you know, this is when monitoring and stuff like that was starting to become popular, mainly with GPS and, you know, sports science was, and sports tech was starting to grow. So I started focusing more on that, still coach though, because at the end of the day, you need to put in a third research, a third in the trenches, just even if you're just working with a high school tennis player or something like that, just spend time learning to see, is the stuff that you're reading really going to be applied? Is it making a difference? Is it practical? And then also with equipment, does this stuff work? Is it cumbersome? Is it an annoyance? Is there a good user experience? That's in 2015, 2016, I worked at a company as a director of innovation called Inside Tracker. And when I started doing blood analysis in the late 90s, to get access to that data required begging a medical doctor to say, you know what, you can spend your own money to get this blood test. I'm going to give you this piece of paper and good luck with it. It wasn't the same as, hey, go to your phone, order the blood test, and then get this app to share all of this information about what you could do with it. So that company was really good because we did a lot of cool things and we had a budget to do innovation. And it was just cool to work with Olympic athletes and use an integrated approach. And just to see that innovation is just awesome because that was radical stuff, because we just looked at challenges and we had to do whatever is necessary to achieve those. So that was a time I was doing that and still coaching, so I could see how the relationships between the physiological side and what you're doing in training. And we had a couple of case studies. It was challenging. I had a guy that had anemia that ate red meat, right? And he had on paper, his diet showed that he should have a good iron levels in the blood, but there's a genetic thing. There is an absorption issue because there's a little bit issue with the microbiome. And so it was just a lot of these little case studies that were really interesting. During that time, I also was going to visit during the summers and the springs, Sweden and Florida, to visit and learn from Håkan Andersson. Really, really progressive coach, wonderful person. And, you know, we did a couple of training camps and, you know, experimenting and stuff that went down to, you know, either Orlando or Tampa Bay and stuff like that. And it was really good for that. Also visited Keenan Robinson when he was working with Phelps. That was an interesting project because that was his comeback year, you know, and to watch him go from basically retired to be that, you know, that star in the Rio Games. It was awesome. Brian Mann was doing some VBT stuff, if you will, experimenting on solutions to deal with barbell placement and protecting the areas that might be exposed. There was a, you know, front squat is a clavicle issue, right? And, you know, nerves and different issues that could be at risk, because everyone thinks about barbell back squatting and lumbar spine, but the upper back that's there, if you don't have a lot of musculature, it becomes not just uncomfortable, but there are times there could be an issue. So that was fun. I mean, I saw some interesting, amazing training down there, and Keenan was really good, and started learning about how swimming could help track and field. So there's a lot of discussion about upper body and sprinting and transferring to the lower body. Same thing with swimming. What does the flutter kick do for freestyle? And how does the trunk and core take the forces of the flutter kick and make them so that the body's stiff. So you're pushing a plank of wood rather than pushing a soft rope. So that made me understand, like, some of the research on the upper body, why it might not be indicative of what's really going down with athletes. So that was, you know, getting outside the box helps you. If you've done all the work inside the original box, you can be creative with a purpose and not just being cute.
So how did you stumble upon slash get in contact with the Inside Tracker people? And do you remember the first moment? Because that was the first, like, techie, sciencey, data-y job. Do you remember that first moment where I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is itching all those scratches that like coaching hasn't done for me yet, kind of like being exposed to that new set of training?
Well, again, I wasn't, you know, not new to, you know, blood data. So to me, I saw it as a service. And to be frank, I saw this as a convenience. I could get this done fast, but I also wanted it to be universal for everyone. It shouldn't be, I didn't want anyone to experience the same struggles that I had, which is, can you get access to the data? Is the data relevant? Are there interventions to improve? And does it matter? You improved a number on a dashboard, did you feel it day to day? The thing that made me really proud was when you hear an athlete said, like, I've been doing all this sleep wearable stuff and I've been dedicating, not going out at night. And now, because I have my red blood cells optimized, I wake up and I'm not tired. So could you imagine, like, oh, everyone's saying, get some sleep, or you're not recovering. And they didn't know, hey, you have someone that's on paper, the algorithm would say he was a low risk for anemia. But it affected his endurance when he played soccer. And that was a lot of learning, because you could follow up with the advice of the best experts, but unless you're actually seeing it, you realize that small little things matter. So for example, if you take iron supplements, you're supposed to take it with vitamin C, correct? What do you usually take for vitamin C?
Some good old orange juice.
Orange juice. Do you know that there's no vitamin C in Whole Foods orange juice?
Oh man, my whole life it's been.
So someone gets the orange juice, right? They're saying, hey, I'm going to dedicate to nutrition. They're going to invest into it. But because the way that the policy is with Whole Foods, it's not that Whole Foods is bad, but orange juice is exactly what it is. It's just the orange juice, but the vitamin C content is not there because there's a safety component. You know, everything that's fresh might be safe for consumption. So making that effort to be a strict diet made things worse, you know, because there's a lot of times people will, you know, what is on the label isn't what really is absorbed and shown. So that was to me about the opportunity to do things and learn with purpose. So that was what really made things interesting for me. And I enjoyed my time and still use the product. To me, I can rely that someone can simply buy a blood test without the barriers that we had 20 years ago.
So what year-ish was this? And then what was the next kind of change?
That was the mid 2010s, you know, 2015 to 2016-ish. And then after that, I went on my own to do more consulting on the technology side. I felt like that kind of crash course of startups. They've been around for a decade, so it's not like they were brand new, but it was just nice to see learning and working with all these other companies to look at challenges. Because, you know, as a guy that is involved with sports science and sports technology, I'm now in the applied side and I'm in the radical innovation side. I'm no longer just trying to, hey, how can we make this a little bit better workflow? There are a lot of challenges in order to overcome big obstacles. So that's when I went on my own. It was scary because I didn't know what to do. But I do know that I did understand that there are a lot of problems out there. And if you dedicate yourself and immerse yourself into the problem, you can help solve problems to help other people. So started doing that with the sports tech, started focusing more on, you know, it was simply faster for almost 8 years. And then last summer, started looking at working directly with companies to make them better. Still visit coaches, still do, design of, I still dabble, but the biggest thing that's most important is getting a piece of equipment or tool and see how we can either iterate to refine it or just blow it up and start over again.
So definitely asking for a friend, how does one seek out these companies? How does one navigate those conversations, and how does one make consulting an actual feasible, profitable, practical lifestyle?
I don't recommend it, honestly, because if you're going to be consulting, that means you have to work with a lot of companies, and that's a lot of strain on your schedule. Sometimes I get a lot of great referrals. I've had a couple cool referrals on the shoewear side. And then sometimes, like, you have to mediate a little bit. There could be an issue with overlap of two companies, and there's a little competition side, but there's also some symbiotic benefit of them working together. So, like, for example, one of the challenges was in 2012, 2013, I felt that the gym-aware system needed to be more in the U.S. because everyone was using Tendo. And this is when Brian Mann, I didn't know who he was, and he released that classic book on velocity-based training, The Whole Origin of VBT. Now, we all know he's a power lifter, so his perspective was there. And, I've been using barbell tracking technology since, the original Muscle Lab. In the U.S., they're selling it probably 23 years ago. So that's when, for me, it was about how to shape the education side, because I was more concerned that the technology would get better, but the gap would get wider. So this is the time where Push was just kind of releasing their IMU wrist warm, and they were trying to get Brian Mann because he had a lot of the ear to the crowd. I was sort of saying, okay, well, GymAware needs to be pushed, no pun intended, because I felt that the quality of the data was high, and I was concerned that IMUs it was just too early. There's another product I did some consulting with called Assess to Perform, and they had the ballistic ball. So there's a lot of good companies that are small companies like that that need feedback. And you don't have to be a consultant to help. Simply being constructive, showing a video clip of maybe something failing, gives them a way to debug. So I think that everyone should be technically a consultant by contributing constructive feedback. As a person that's in the tech space, once you work with a handful of companies, it becomes a curse, because then you're getting, you have to coordinate and you have to educate. Simply Faster was good because I got my hands on a lot of tech, and I could see where the trajectory of things were going. In fact, a lot of the articles I have are laced with Easter eggs to kind of hint to what will be coming out down the road. So, like, one company that I'm really was really proud of to collaborate with, they're struggling right now. And I won't name them, but because they had an issue with, not having the marketing. Conversely, there's another company that's out there that's doing amazing marketing stuff, but the product doesn't work. There's a VBT product that is camera-based, and it can't do bar tracking, in terms of getting the bar path. It's expensive. It's incomplete. Yet everyone's promoting it because they want to feel like, hey, we're cutting edge, we're doing this for recruiting. So, like, a company like VMAX Pro, I was concerned that it would cannibalize the GymAware, but it was time to move on. Not that the LPT is the problem, it's not the technology, it's just the accessibility to the high school market. And so for months, I begged basically Christopher from Simply Faster, you got to convert, because if they were to go somewhere else, then it doesn't help the long run for the community. So it was like 2019 before the pandemic, and the timing was perfect because they just made it available in March, and then everything shut down, and coaches were able to learn not about bar speed, but about motion capture, technique, motor skill acquisition, you know, all of those details. So, you know, from a consulting side, I work with anyone that wants to innovate, and they're not afraid to be creative, not afraid to ask tough questions and be accountable. And, you know, I think I'm going to continue to do that for a little bit. And then who knows, I might just say, you know, this is old news, or, you know, who knows, I could be finding myself, you know, getting involved with tactical performance more. Who knows?
What is one thing that people don't know about you that if they learned, they definitely would be super surprised or maybe not even believe you? Whether it's training E or just you, like a random hobby or skill or...
Oh, hobby. Ooh. Well, I'm proud to say that contrary to popular opinion, I do have a hobby now. So if people... with people to know that I'd never thought I'd get involved and get my degree in exercise science or whatever. I thought I was going to be a comic book illustrator, and I was going to settle probably for something in between because that's not exactly an easy job to land. I was thinking about being an architect. So, but the great thing is that a very supportive family, and, you know, just decided to do what I thought was I was blessed with, which is, you know, great coaches in high school said that, you know, this is something that if you can enjoy it. And I did. So I think that's the only surprise factor, that I'm a much better artist than I am a technology expert or whatever. But for me, it's just just something I feel like is part of me, but not something I want to do to put stress onto it so that you are compromising things. You know, I like the outlet of art. I don't like the pressure from a business standpoint. Not that there's a conflict of interest there, but I do think that's not for everyone. I think art is a very difficult world. There's a reason they call it starving artist. Not everyone makes it. And so for me, I think that's where the biggest surprise is that I'm probably, my only talents. I think I'm a hard worker and I read. And I put effort, but that's probably the biggest surprise.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a fine line between, you know, quote unquote, doing what you love, but at the end of the day, you have bills to pay.
Yep.
And when you start to monetize and put that pressure on it, because there's so many opportunities with, you know, just the internet and social media.
Yeah.
To truly, anyone could theoretically monetize anything, then it takes away that initial thing that I gave you in the beginning. So super interesting for sure, but I definitely would not have guessed that. So we're getting near the end here. If you had any knowledge bombs to drop on the listener, anything short, sweet, what have you found yourself saying a lot recently to colleagues, younger coaches? And then I'll roll out the red carpet for you after that.
Sure. I think the biggest thing is to seek the truth. Sometimes it's humbling. So you said every day, what should you do to kind of make yourself better? For me, it's a never ending sculpture where you're trying to remove what you don't want. And to me, it's misinformation. My dad was a technology and computer person. And, you know, I did that as for 10, 15 years, and I did that full time. Being in technology, but I always separated that from, coaching, because I thought there were two separate entities, if you will. And it wasn't the data science, but it's all about finding out what the truth is. Now with technology, it's very binary, either it works or it doesn't. And I've always had a problem combining art and science. So to me, it's like, the truth is that art and science is only compatible when you really know both really well. So I think that coaches understand working with people, but that's not really art. That's just basically being a good communicator or good social skills. I think that there's more to that. So for me, it's always pursuing what the convergence is. And to me, it's like every day I said, is this improving the art and science of coaching? And it's humbling because some days you just have filler days. You go out there and just doing damage control. So I don't know. I mean, I think that if I was to give advice to a young person starting out, I would say is find people that are known getting results and then work with those people for longer than you should. Meaning don't just do an internship for 3 to 6 months, do 2 years. And the reason I say that is because usually on year two is where you understand what people are doing on year one versus this hit and run mentality of like, let me load my CV with all these experiences, but they're just basically, you know, padding a resume. So I don't know. I mean, I just look at, as I learned, and it's very humbling not to, there's something that I think you should look at since you've been using a lot of the technology. And it's pretty cool that, you know, actually one of my influences is his daughter got tested by you. Heck, you know, that yeah. He was, Matt was my, my neighbor when I grew up, and he was an amazing athlete. And I idolized him. He had everything going for him because he was great at sports, great academically. He was popular, and he was my neighbor, and he was a year older than me. And I looked that up and said, you know what? Those 2 years where I, you know, got rides and was a, you know, junior and sophomore year, I think those had a big effect on me because he was always trying to pursue how to get better every day. And I see, I think that is something where I think people, they always say that, but to commit to it is very humbling because you'll have days that you don't get better and you have to be accountable. Mm. So, you know, I know that was a little bit long-winded, but, you know, this process for me is just, I'm halfway done. And I do know that to pace myself, I got to find a way to stay, make sure I'm passionate and then I'm learning. If I'm having those two things, I don't think burnout will be a problem. And I think I can make changes without having to sacrifice. Mm. So.
I like the analogy of a sculpture and taking away stuff to figure out kind of like what the truth is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a gazillion ways to like skin a cat, quote unquote, you know, to give another eye roll worthy analogy.
Yeah.
But it's almost figuring out what, you know, like how many ways are there to get faster, to get stronger? How many cues are there for top speed sprinting and technique drills? But it's like figure out what's efficient, what gets the job done, what you can scale for one athlete group of 100 different age groups. So it's almost process of elimination just over the long run and then kind of going from there. So I want to say thank you very much for your candidness, for your openness, for some things that I think might make it to the internet for the first time ever. Getting you to chat about a little bit different of a topic, which is kind of the point of TSP, but I want to roll out the red carpet for you to shamelessly, emphasis on shameless, plug whatever you got to plug and where can people get more of you?
Yeah, I mean, right now I am tweeting for Spikes Only as a, you know, like people think that it's only me, but in fact, it's actually other people. Mm. And what I'm trying to do is just stir the pot with good, finding good research, good examples of training and retweeting. I don't do anything really else on the social media side for that. If you want to message me direct, you know, I can just DM and you'll get in touch with me. I am focusing on starting another website, and it's going to be on the sports tech side emphasis, track and field and Formula One and Olympic sport and team sport. I love it. I just want to make sure it's separated. So when that is out, I probably will put that onto social media so that people can focus on the sports tech and the data science stuff there. And then the coaching is always going to be something that's just a passion. So besides that, nothing else.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much again, and I'm looking forward to chatting next.
All right. Thank you for your time.